I do not want to go over the questions, do you? Question or comment about the questions before we set them aside? They are 2 weeks old now anyways, they're stale. Okay.
I thought they were good.
Excellent. Judges chapter 1. Judges chapter 1, we did the introduction last week, we're going to go on into the text today. So, it came about after the death of Joshua that the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, saying, "Who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand." Note well that there is the beginning of a transfer in preeminence here. Basically, do you remember what tribe Joshua was from? Ephraim. Okay? And Ephraim had played a significant role up until now, and now there's going to be a subtle shift away from Ephraim to Judah, and eventually culminating in when David becomes king. So that's why, this is part of the reason why you often read Ephraim, Ephraim, Ephraim. Why Ephraim? Well, because they used to be preeminent, not anymore after this. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have this kind of explicit direction from God? God, who do you want us to lead? Judah will go up. Wouldn't that be fantastic if we could have that? What school should I go to? God? God tells you, go to this school over here. What job should I get? What house should I buy? What house shouldn't I buy? What boy, what girl should I pursue? On and on. Wouldn't that be so nice? Do we have anything like that? Can you think of some explicit direction that we have?
In the things that matter regarding sin, it's very explicit.
Right. And in fact, you quote this more than anybody else in here when I asked the specific question. 2 Peter 1:3. Do you remember it right now? Okay, well, you will as soon as I say it. God has given us all things pertaining to life and godliness, right? And in what? In the clouds, in the trees, in we read the tea leaves? Or how has he given us all things to pertaining to life and godliness? Say it again. Scripture, right? 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17, so on and so forth. So, it's not that we don't actually have this. We have explicit direction for any situation we'll be in. Not in every situation we'll be in. It's not like here we are, we're in the situation, and we say, God help us, and zap, he gives us the answer or anything like that. We have it for every, it doesn't matter what situation we might find ourselves in, the New Testament and Old Testament put together, they'll help you understand what God has chosen. Okay, so if we don't have it in every situation, then how can we get to be where, when we're in the situation, we make a wise decision? How do we get there?
Read.
Read what?
Read the Bible and
pray. Read and pray. Anything else that you can think of? Read and pray.
Study diligently.
Discuss it. Anything else that anybody can think of? These are all good. John? Jonathan? Sorry, what?
Train your conscience.
Train your conscience with the word. Hebrews 5, you remember? Hebrews 5. Solid food is for the mature who, because of practice, have their senses trained to discern good and evil. So we have, here it is. If you ever have a question, there's the answer. But man, we don't have him directly, explicitly, in every given situation saying, here's the answer, Lee, here's the answer. I wouldn't have to think then, would I? So how do we get to the point where we actually make the wisest choice? Because we practice. We take what we know, we apply it, we learn a little bit more, we grow, we read, we take what we know, we apply it. A violin. You practice violin, don't you? What happens to a violin that isn't played?
Gets out of tune.
Gets out of tune, and you can't use it again. The more you use a violin, the more beautiful it sounds, the more beautiful it sounds. We're the violin, and God's Word, he's the one stroking us. And the more that we allow him, through his Word, to move us, the better we'll be. So, back here in Judges, chapter 1, the Lord said, Judah shall go up. I have given the land into his hand. Judah said to Simeon, his brother, they're from the same mother, by the way, that's one reason why it says his brother, come up with me into the territory allotted to me, that we might fight against the Canaanites, and I in turn will go with you into the territory allotted you. So Simeon went up with him. Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hands, and they defeated 10,000 men at Bezek. Then they find Adonai Bezek in Bezek, and fought against him. And they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and Adonai Bezek fled. And they pursued him and cut off his thumbs and his big toes. Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off used to gather up the scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. So they brought him to Jerusalem and he died there. Okay, this king, this king in the land of Canaan, one reason why would they cut his hands, his thumbs and his big toes off? Why would they do that? What would it do to him? It would cripple him. So what couldn't he do to them anymore? He couldn't hurt them, right? This is a preventative measure. Okay. Here's something interesting, though. What did they do to him? Or let us ask this question. What didn't they do to him? They didn't kill him. And that sets the tone for the rest of this book. Gary.
You have to wonder with this. It's not told, but is God, told them to do that to him because what he did to others? You know what I'm saying? Is there some sort of recompense here to this Adonai Bezek?
It may be. It may be. I mean, the way I'm coming at it is, he was in the land of the Canaanites. He was a king, and what are they supposed to do to the Canaanites? Right. What they did to everybody else there, right, they just spared the king. So if there was some explicit, direct exception for him, we don't have it.
Right. Does say, well, just as I used to cut the big toes and thumbs off of other people and make them gather the thumbs under my table, so it being done to me.
What goes around comes around. God certainly makes sure of that, doesn't he, right? Okay, so they don't kill him. The sons of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it. All right, we read this, I hope, maybe even this week, but certainly last week in preparation. I'm not going to read the whole thing. We read about Othniel and Caleb's younger brother. Verse 16, we read about the Kenites, Moses' father-in-law. Verse 19, the Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country. What is your next word? But. They could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had iron chariots. Look in verse 21. The sons of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem, so the Jebusites lived with the sons of Benjamin to this day. Verse 22, likewise in the house of Joseph. Verse 27, Manasseh did not take possession of Bethshea and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, so the Canaanites persisted living in the land. Verse 29, Ephraim did not. 30, Zebulun did not. 31, Asher did not. 33, Naphtali did not. 34, the Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country. So not only, does anybody remember from report card days incomplete? They get an incomplete. What are they supposed to do? Go in and wipe everybody out. And all, if you ever looked on a map, they're everywhere. Canaanites are everywhere. They get an incomplete. And not only that, this is embarrassing. The Amorites are forcing the Danites, instead of the Danites chasing with one of 10,000 people, the Danites are being chased themselves. So no wonder God appears, chapter 2, verse 1. The angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you out of Egypt and led you into the land which I have sworn to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. As for you, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed me. What is this you have done? Therefore, I also said, I will not drive them out from before you, but they will become as thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. When the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and they wept. And who wasn't there anymore to save them? Who used to? Yes, and before that, really, it's been a long time now, but Moses. Every time something like this happened, they'd wept. And who would throw himself on his face? Moses. Not anymore. And what do they know now? Boy, oh boy, they shouldn't have ever gotten into this spot to begin with. Because now Moses isn't around. You know, that God did not destroy them. That's what I would have done in my anger. I told you to do this. And repeatedly, time after time after time after time after time, all of you have disobeyed me. I'll tell you what I would have done. I would have destroyed them. At least I would have left them. Does he destroy them? Does he abandon them? No. Why not?
Test.
What kind of a God is our God?
Merciful.
A merciful God. They break the covenant, and yet later it will be a test. But for now, he's being merciful to them. In fact, look in verse 6. So they named that place Bochim, or Bochim, or however you want to say it. If you have a footnote there, it says weeping, or weepers, or crying, or wailing, or something like that. Let me tell you something. If Lee Tosti named the location of every sin that I have ever committed, do you know what a megalopolis is? Here's a megalopolis. You're flying over the country at nighttime, and you're going over Kansas. You look down. How many lights do you see? Not many. But when you go over the I-95 corridor, how many do you see? Totally lit up. That's Lee's life right there. If I just took one sin, impatience, that would be it. And yet every time I have a light lit up down there, and I'm not dead because God hasn't punished me, I'm reminded emphatically of his patience and his mercy. If you named all the places that you've sinned, Bochim or whatever it might be, every time you do that, you remember, isn't our God a merciful God? If you have a comment or question, let me know. We're going to keep going through here. Joshua dismissed the people. So that's a little bit of a flashback, right? Verse 7, the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua. And all who had seen all the great work of the Lord, which he had done for Israel. Then Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at 110. They buried him in the territory of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. All that generation were also gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. Stop here. Ultimately, whose fault was it that they didn't know the work of the Lord or the Lord? Ultimately, whose fault was that?
Their own.
Do you remember what Joshua did? We didn't emphasize this too much when we passed over it in the last chapter of Joshua. But they made this covenant. We will serve the Lord. And what did he do? He made a covenant. And do you remember where he put it? In the book of the law. Moses, when he was dying, added to the book that he's been writing for 40 years, right? They have this book there. All they got to go is do is go and look at it. So from now on, what you know is this. From now on, anything they do wrong is whose fault? Their own. They are without excuse. Comment or question here? So, the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were around them, bowed themselves down to them, and thus they provoked the Lord to anger. Baals, in verse 11, is plural. Baal, do you know what Baal means? Lord, somebody said Lord? Yeah, master, Lord, king, whatever we have, right? Baal's plural. Understand that, okay, so Baal was a chief Canaanite god. Actually, Mesopotamian first, and all these gods are all mixed up. It says plural, Baals, because these gods would manifest themselves in all these different communities. Here in Philadelphia, we have one god. Up there in Oxbow, we have another god. Down the road in Evans Mills, there's another god. But it's all Baal of some kind, okay? Or one manifestation of Baal, or related to Baal, or Baal's offspring, or something like that. Here, can you read the far right? Can you read this at all? Anybody? It doesn't matter. There's approximately 40 gods there. Gods. These are the false gods of the Bible, okay? My point is, there are false gods all over, and we're really going to start reading about them now in Judges, and all through the rest of our Old Testaments especially. If you would like, I have up here 5 copies of that. I can make more. But these are the false gods in the Old Testament. You can't read it, but right here it says Baal of Peor. Remember Peor? What happened there? Peor, I don't know how you pronounce it, but what happened there? Do you remember who came out and said? So Balaam and Balak were there, right? And that is where they played the harlot with the Moabites, okay? Well, Baal of Peor, see, Baal of this location, Baal of that location, Baal of this location, Baal of that location. So here they are running around serving multiple gods, not just one. They don't forsake the Lord for just one. They're doing this everywhere. And what does that emphasize? Their sin. This is not just a fluke accident. They're doing it everywhere they go. So, the Lord, they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtaroth, a consort of Baal's. And the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. You read this for last week. This describes that cycle, right? And so the Lord would condemn them and they'd cry out to the Lord. They'd be delivered. They'd be obedient. Then they'd forsake the Lord. Verse 20. So the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and has not listened to my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, in order to test Israel by them, whether they will keep the way of the Lord to walk in it as their fathers did or not. So the Lord allowed those nations to remain, not driving them out quickly. He did not give them into the hand of Joshua. Now these are the nations which the Lord left to test Israel, that is, all who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan, only in order that the generations of the sons of Israel might be taught war, those who had not experienced it formerly. These are the nations. And then in 3 and 4, it talks about these nations. Quick note, if you have something to say, please do. Number one, yes, John.
He's given them an open book test.
Yes.
And they failed it.
Right. It's exactly right. Yeah. A job half done is not is a job not done at all. Right? They were doing wonderfully. The Lord was with them. But. And then we know the rest of the story. Do you remember the parable of the man of the talents? The man who was given one talent. If he had lost that talent, that would have been utter failure, right? He didn't lose it. So that ought to be good enough, right? It wasn't good enough, was it? Not only was he not supposed to lose it, but he was also supposed to make more money with it. A job half done is a job not done at all. So what's the lesson? Finish the job, right? Sin has lasting consequences. They don't kick the people out of the land. God says, I'm not going to kick them out of the land anymore. They're going to stay in the land. And so they were severely distressed. And what do you think they were thinking while they were severely distressed? This is horrible. Look what we have done. We have nobody else to blame, only ourselves. Look what we have done. And if they could push a button and eject themselves from the situation, what do you think they'd do? So what's the lesson? Finish the job, right? Or do the job right the first time. Or, don't mess up to begin with. The last one, don't mess up to begin with, is stay away from original sin. And then finish the job is perseverance of the saints, isn't it? Sin has lasting consequences. Let me read something to you that Paul Earnhardt wrote back in 1988. Idealism comes rather easily to the young. They feel the strength of their youth and find it natural to dream dreams and see visions. Their vision of truth and right is pure and undivided, not yet obscured by the dark memory of countless personal shortfalls. Their consciences, though slightly bruised, are not yet deeply wounded and scarred. I confess I love this special quality in young people, their wholehearted enthusiasm for a high purpose of their capacity for a heroic commitment to it. But it is the very naivety of their youthful idealistic dreams that can put them at risk. Now, you might be young and thinking, I don't like that. But listen to what this old man said about himself. Listen to what he said. They are not yet deeply wounded and scarred. How does he feel? This is what happens as you grow older. Get used to it. If you're better than older people, then it won't happen to you. Strive for that. But be prepared for it at the same time. Avoid sin. Avoid sin. Get rid of it. Go around it. Stay away from it. Or you will live the rest of your life remembering that one thing that's in the closet from long ago. Comments or questions? Why didn't Israel finish the job? In verse 19 of chapter 1, they could not drive out the inhabitants because they had iron chariots. They couldn't. Apparently they could not. That's what it says. I'm wrong.
They lack faith.
What's an iron chariot look like? It seems to be too heavy to pull with a horse. But it's got to mean something other than just a straight cast iron chariot.
Yeah, or multiple horses. Yeah, they would pull them with two or four horses often. These are probably two from all my reading back there. Maybe four.
That certainly has something to do with iron.
Well, okay, it could have been, they could have been tanks.
They didn't have one tank.
Right. Why, as you said, look in verse 20. Oh, by the way, Joshua had done what to the horses? They had chariots, not iron chariots that we know of. It doesn't say iron back in Joshua 8 or wherever it is. He hamstrung the horses. In chapter 4, Barak is about to chase chariots, iron, 900 iron chariots all over the place with Israel. How many horses does Israel have? None. Because God said, you cannot multiply horses because you have to trust me. Later on, David will be the first one to say, oh, I think I'll spare 100 horses, I think it is. I forget how many. Anyway, in verse 20, Caleb drove out the sons of Anak. You remember who those dudes were? What, would you rather face a giant 9-something feet tall or a horse? Neither. I don't like the odds. I don't like the options. I quit. I go home. Right? And listen to this. Verse 28. It came about when Israel became strong that they slaughtered all the Canaanites like they should have to begin with. That is the problem. When they actually had the ability, they all had the ability all along if they trusted in God. When they weren't trusting in God and they had the ability, did they still do it? No. They didn't do it, which means the problem was all along that they didn't have faith in God. At the same time, this is, if you look at a map and pinpoint these locations, you see this is all over Israel. This wasn't just one isolated problem. This was all over. If you run into somebody who's been a Christian for 50 years, and he or she still smokes, still swears all the time, drinks all the time, lusts all the time, goes out partying all the time, does this, does that, has bad attitude, what would you know about them?
They tried very hard, haven't they?
They haven't tried. It's exactly it. They didn't want it. They didn't want it. It's all over. They're in a culture of comfort. Everybody's doing it. Everybody's not doing it, I should say. And so they're just all right with it. They didn't want it enough. Two things about our faith. Number one, our faith should be this. Number one, Lord, your will, not mine. And then once you've got that pounded into your head and you're facing the obstacle, Lord, give me faith. You've said I can beat these chariots without horses. So I should be able to do it. Let's go. It's easy to talk about it up here in this cozy little room. When it comes to when the rubber hits the road, don't forget everything that you have said here. And thank God for His grace and His mercy. Gracie and His mercy. Mercy and His grace. Comments, questions? Gary?
And when you're faced with different situations, ask God what to do in this situation. What does God think? What does God want me to do in this situation? When we start relying on, I think I can do this. Yeah. I can do this. That's what they thought. We can do this. We just put them under tribute.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they feel. What did God want me to do? What does God want me to do? Ask ourselves every time, every situation, what does God want me to do?
Yeah.
And do it.
Leave the thinking to Him.
Yeah, do it.
And don't be surprised by the text.
Yeah.
I mean, right. They should have been surprised by that.
Right. Yeah. How often are we surprised by that? In fact, when do we usually realize that we just failed the test? Afterward.
Yeah, when we relied on ourselves.
What? I just failed the test. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Second generation faith does not guarantee regenerating faith, does it? They were all fine. Everybody. All that generation were also gathered. And then there arose another generation who did not know the Lord. Right? So you can, just because somebody has, my dad has faith and his father had faith and his father had faith and his father, I can count back 10 generations, all these people had faith. Does that mean anything? Not necessarily, right?
It means you got less of an excuse.
Huh? That's exactly right.
Maybe,
so
maybe they didn't teach their children.
Oh, look at, oh, we're coming. Yeah, okay. Parents must live their faith. The first, what do you do? How do we help the next generation have faith? Number one, you live your faith. Live it consistently too, right? That's what we have to do. Number two, pray like there's no tomorrow. And then, as Ian said, parents must teach their children not only the correct answers, but also how to arrive at the correct answers. You know, I can't tell you how many people I've seen and talked to that grew up going to churches where these churches try to follow the pattern. But by the time these children are growing up, you know what's not explained to them anymore? How to get to there. And it's just what for them? Just a tradition. And so then they go off, they go talk to somebody else, and the other person says, how do you come up with that idea? That's totally inconsistent. Look what you do here, look what you do there. And the person says, you know what? You're right. And because they haven't been taught how to approach the conclusion, they think, wait a minute, and I grew up in this and I don't know. If I don't know, then what? There must not be a way. And so they leave it. The same thing when kids nowadays, what is a university nowadays, but someplace, I forget the numbers, maybe some of you have it. The numbers of quote-unquote believers who go into universities come out atheists or skeptics. How many?
It's staggering.
It's unbelievable. And that doesn't have to be, because there are plenty that went into college with strong faith and came out and had taught other people. What's the difference? Quite probably what their parents taught them, what their parents prepared them for. Look, there is an alternative opinion out there that there is no God. Here's the evidence for it. What do you think, son?
Well, that and their Bob Mars, they're dumped.
Right.
I mean, they're living in a sense in a sheltered world. You know, they're living amongst the choir. Then you dump them in Sodom.
Right.
What happened to Lot?
Yeah.
Sodom,
yeah. Yeah. Just had a thought. It escaped me. That's okay. Anybody else with a thought? Good. Excellent. Quickly, about the Kenites. Descendants of the Kenites, Moses' father-in-law. Why did the Kenites stick around? They're not Jews. They're Kenites. Right? Why did they stick around? There are two reasons that we know of.
Moses' father-in-law was a priest of some kind, wasn't he?
Midian. And what did he say? They came out, and Moses sat down and explained to them, this is what Jehovah has done for us. And do you remember how he replied? In Exodus 18. Now I know that Jehovah is the strongest God. Oh, I can't believe I don't remember it. Exodus 18. Now I know the Lord is greater than all the gods. He still doesn't have it all figured out, but you know what he knows? Jehovah. And so he sticks around. And then, when they're leaving Mount Sinai, that's when they arrive at Mount Sinai. When they're leaving Mount Sinai, do you remember what Moses says? He says, come along with us. And you remember the offer they make? The offer is, look, everywhere we go, with the Lord blesses us, we will do good for you. That's Numbers chapter 10. We'll do good for you. At first, they're like, no, we're going to stick around over here. Moses says to him, look, if you go with us, whenever the Lord blesses us, we'll do good for you. And here they are. So we have two reasons. Number one, they knew about God. Number two, the quality of godly people. Let me ask this question for you. Is there anybody in the world, should there ever be a time, when somebody has a friend who is a Christian, that that person isn't in a good situation? That was probably a poorly worded question. The idea is, Christians should always be what? A good or a bad influence? Good things should happen to people who are around Christians. Maybe not physically. Maybe physically. But at least spiritually, these people who are around Christians, good things should happen to them. Isn't it sad when the Christian is the cause of something bad? May that never be us in our situation. Comment or question on this? Okay. Chapter 3 continues. The sons of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And they took their daughters for themselves as wives, and they gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, forgot the Lord their God, and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim, I hope, king of Mesopotamia. And the sons of Israel served that dude 8 years. When the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the sons of Israel to deliver them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. And that guy's a fantastic person. Do you notice what happened here? First of all, what was the progression, what were the steps into captivity? The first thing they did is they did not kick out everybody in the land. What was number two? They married them. Did you see that? They lived among them, verse 5, verse 6, they married them. Verse 7, verse 6, they served their gods. Here's a quick question for you. Are you thinking about marrying? Gary.
Just a point I wish I'm very, very interested here in this section.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they turn from Jehovah to serve the other gods, and it isn't the other gods that put them under tribute. It's a king from Mesopotamia, way over on the other side of the Euphrates. He comes over there and puts the whole section under. Then who eventually takes them into captivity years later?
Yeah.
A king from Mesopotamia.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Thinking about getting married? Consider these verses. There's only a couple in the Bible that talk about this.
Only a couple?
Do you see the connection? They took daughters for themselves, and then they served the gods. Genesis chapter 6, right before God is about to destroy the whole world, the sons of God saw the daughters of men were beautiful, they took wives for themselves, and God said, "That's enough." Whatever it is, it doesn't matter what you think about this, these marriages were messed up, and that's what led to the destruction. So be careful what kind of marriage you get into, right? Then, Genesis 24, Abraham talks to his servant, "I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven, the God of earth, that you shall not take my wife from among the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live." Don't do it. Why not? Well, he says, because God brought me here, and God wants something special for us, is the point. 27:46, this is Rebekah talking about her son. "If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth, from the Canaanites, what good will my life be to me?" I think she feels rather strongly about this. "Why? You shall make no covenant with them," skip to the end, "for if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you." I copied that, and that's the way it is written. Exodus 34, "Make no covenant with them. Someone might invite you to eat his sacrifice, and you might take some of their daughters and their sons and his daughters and might play the harlot with their gods." Don't do it. And by the way, if there's a couple more here that we have listed. 1 Kings 11, 1 through 9. What's that talking about? Solomon. When Solomon, go ahead.
Solomon had to hate him.
Yeah.
I mean, he lived in the most glorious time, Israel's most glorious time. What turned the nation upside down? Marrying
foreign women, not just one. Marrying multiple foreign women, although it could have been just one. And I mean, if you read this text here, he built altar after altar after altar after altar to these people, these gods. Now, let me ask you this quick question here. What do you think Solomon would say after God comes and says, I'm stripping the kingdom from you. What do you think Solomon would say then? What about these people in the book of Judges here? They go and they marry their daughters and their sons, and then they serve the other gods, and God comes along and sends them to Mesopotamia, or to be overruled by Mesopotamia for 8 years. What do they say? If they were going to advise you about marrying, intermarrying with non-godly people, what would these people say now? Don't do it. Don't look what's going to happen.
What would Ezra tell him?
You're right.
What did he tell
him? Ian.
Well, when you think about it, it's probably the mothers who teach the children. And so the teaching, if you marry out of your faith, your children are going to be tied to a faith that's probably not yours.
Whether it's mothers or... parents are given the responsibility, but yes, that's exactly right. If you marry out of... If you are a Christian and you marry somebody who's not... You know, Dan Bunting made this excellent point this other day. I never thought of it. It was Saturday. And he said, you think you're going to influence them? It's not going to happen. Now, yes, sometimes it will, but what's the trend, okay? What's the trend? He said, look... Those Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they stood up. Did they influence anybody? No. How was Nebuchadnezzar influenced eventually? Only by God's miraculous intervention. That's when they were influenced. It is not going to happen. Stay away from them. Get away from them. As he said the other day, if you bounce into them in the grocery store, fantastic. Try to teach them as you can. But don't go to the bar with them. I'm talking with a friend that I'm supposed to be studying with. Last night on the phone, 2 nights ago on the phone, I don't know when it was, he lost his girlfriend. I said, well, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm going to the bar. And this is somebody who's supposed to be converted. I said, what do you think you're doing? Well, maybe I can help them there. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. Stay away. Comment? Somebody else had a hand up somewhere like an hour ago. Okay. Yeah. Consider those passages. All right. Next comes... Ehud, one of my favorite stories. And then Shamgar. I just read verse 31. Shamgar, the son of Anath, came after him. This is chapter 3, verse 31. Who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. And he also saved Israel. Okay, Ehud's tactics were unconventional. Shamgar strikes down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. Gary, what's an ox goad?
Pointed stick.
That's just...
It's interesting you call Ehud's unconventional when he calls Shamgar.
Right. They're both unconventional. Yeah, that's really the point I'm trying to make. Two things here. God can save any way he wants, and God can save even in strange ways, can't he? An ox goad? Like Samson, right? Who will do it with what? A jawbone. A donkey's jawbone. Talk about unconventional... Can you think of, maybe in the New Testament, a quote-unquote unconventional way to be saved? You've got to be kidding me. You have to do that? What? It makes no sense in the whole wide world. Everything else in this kingdom is spiritual, and you want me to do what? Go down. Can you imagine the Ethiopian eunuch? Can you repeat that to me, Philip? I didn't quite get that part. When you preached Jesus to me, I didn't get the part where you said, go down into the water, fully get under the water and come back out. That's the way I'll be saved? I can't picture Enoch saying that because Enoch had the attitude of what? The Ethiopian eunuch. Whatever I have to do. As opposed to Naaman in the Old Testament, when he was told, do this unconventional thing, he got angry and said, I'm not going to do it at all. And they said, look, just do it. And he said, yeah, that's pretty good advice. And he just did it. God can do strange things. Whatever it is, whatever we think of it, just do it.
God says to do it, just do it.
Right, just do it. That was God's originally, okay? Nike doesn't own that one. All right, chapter 4 and chapter 5. Does anybody remember, I don't expect you to, don't worry, I won't be insulted if you don't. Does anybody remember when I, me preaching on this? Do you remember how long ago it was? Take a guess, quick.
Three.
In 2 weeks, 3 years ago. Four lessons. I brought them here. I'm going to do them all again. Three years ago, I was floored. I said, that can't be. That's great, because only two more years, I'll be able to do it again. Okay. So, the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. I'm not reading all of this. It's too much, and the question is with this text is with all what to cut. And so we're going to cut a lot. If you have a point, please bring it up. He raises up, I've got to be careful with the wording. He raised up Deborah as a mother. That's her language. He uses Deborah as a judge. And then Barak, of course, they destroy Jabin, the king of Canaan. And in chapter 5, verse 31, there is, the land was undisturbed for 40 years. So that's the story there. How'd you like that? Go ahead.
Chapter 4, verse 1 shows the overlapping of judges. Which kind of shows some overlapping of judges. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's more than one happening at one time.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, that might be relatively important for understanding chapter 4 and chapter 5. Let me say this about Deborah. Okay, here is what I... First of all, do you know what this is used for, this text? Judges chapter 4?
Women to preach.
Women to preach, women to rule, women to lead, women to do everything that 1 Timothy and other places say they should not do, all right? We don't need to address it so much in depth, but I'll just tell you what I think is going on here to begin with, and then I'll refute this position. What I think is going on in Deborah's time, in short, is the men were not being the men. And I think that's what this is actually teaching us. I think that's the underlying theme in the whole thing. First of all, she says, Barak, come over here, go over there and deliver them. The Lord has called you, deliver them, right? And what does he say to her? Verse 8, if you, who? A woman, will go with me. If you will go with me, then I will go. All right, let's put Joshua there. A woman comes up to him, he comes up to the woman, and the woman says to him, you need to go beat up these people. Can you picture Joshua saying, only if you go with me? Do you picture it? No, what about Samson? What about David? What about the men who were men and led? No, you don't picture that. Yet Barak says, I'm only going to go if you, a woman, goes with me. That in of itself is it implies something's wrong. Her response, I will surely go with you. The honor will not be yours. It will be whose? A woman's. That's a slap in the face. Back there, you know, we think a little differently now. So let's step back into the world where men were men. And if a woman, in fact, we'll read in a couple other places where Abimelech says, kill me. I want to commit suicide so it doesn't appear that a woman has killed me, when in fact a woman had killed him, right? Here, she says, okay, I'll go with you, but you're not going to get the credit for this. It's going to go to a woman. That right there is whack, right in his face. You should be the man who you should be. Verse 9. I will surely go with you, nevertheless. Number one, she doesn't want to go. Number two, she should not have had to go. Number three, she's only going because he is weak. That's a third thing. Then in chapter 5, verse 2, this song that they're singing, the leaders led in Israel. That the leaders led in Israel, that the people volunteered. Okay, that first line, that the leaders led in Israel. Does anybody have anything that's radically different from that? The leaders led in Israel. If you look at your footnotes, it will say something about hair.
Locks are
the locks says that warriors in Israel unbound their hair, that the people came forward with a will, for this was Yahweh.
Okay. That one adds more than some of the others, okay? It doesn't say anything about the warriors. Verse 2, that the leaders led. That word, the leaders, is literally or can be literally also translated the long-haired ones. The long-haired ones led. Now, is that necessarily referring to women? Not necessarily. But it sure could be. And the whole context here we see underneath it is the men were not being the men. So, either one of two things is happening in verse 2. That the leaders led in Israel, it's praise for Barak that he finally stood up and acted like a man. Yes, you've finally done it. Verse 9, my heart goes out to the commanders of Israel. They finally led. Or it's sarcasm saying the women were the leaders. That could be the case. I can't be too confident there in my assertion. But note, whatever your translation is, it's their opinion and I'm giving you mine. Okay? The whole idea seems to be, or is underneath here, that the men were not being the men. And so the lesson is, men, be men. If the men back there were being men, Deborah wouldn't have had to go to war, and Jael wouldn't have been the one to kill. That wouldn't have happened. If the men are doing their jobs, the women will not have to. Russia, if the men are doing their jobs, the women will not have to. In fact, if the men are doing their jobs, there's only one spot at this hierarchy, this position. There's only one spot, so you can't fill it with another one. It's logically impossible. So if the men are doing their jobs, the women can't. But if the men are doing the jobs, the women won't also. Russia is a matriarchal society. It means mother rules, right? Okay. What has happened? And to go there, it's sad, but also funny. It would be hilarious if it weren't so sad to see what's going on here. These women rule. I mean, they rule the roost. With an iron thumb, iron fist, an iron thumb. That's all they need. That's how tough they are. Okay, so what has happened is, what I have heard has happened is, the men started getting drunker and drunker. Well, if the men are drunk, they can't do their job, but the job has to be done, and so the women started taking over. So now what we have this situation where the women complain about the men all the time. And what do the men do? They get drunk, and what do? Complain about the women all the time. My wife is hard on me. My husband won't do anything. And now we have this endless cycle of complaining because the men won't be the men. And nowadays, the women won't let the men be the men either. If we need to separate this. This passage is one of those that teaches that. Let the men be the men and women be women. Go ahead.
Can you say that about Putin?
He's KGB. He's different.
I was going to say, he's a man's man. Ain't
yeah, he's a man's man. Yep. Maybe his wife. Actually, I would be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised. But we can talk about that later. But I would not be surprised at all. He does look like it, though, doesn't he? No, right. All right, I'm going to skip this part because you'll remember it from 3 years ago very clearly. I know you do. Okay. Read this next thing. Deborah. Hardly a hero for the feminist. She did not use her position to promote women's lib, did she? You read chapter 4 and chapter 5, and you don't walk away with somebody who is woman power at all. The exact opposite, actually. She didn't start a school of prophets or female judges. Jael, the one who killed it, didn't start the paramilitary academy for girls. She did not present herself as an authority. She framed her commands as in what? Questions and the Lord says, right? Hardly the approach of somebody lusting after power. She did not consider it an accomplishment to accompany Barak. Not at all. That's a little different than now. But an embarrassment for all men and even herself. That was an embarrassment for Sisera to have a woman come on the field. She identified herself as a mother, not as a leader. I arose a mother. Now, if she's lusting after power, guess what she's not going to say? I'm a mommy. That's hardly the way it goes nowadays, right? Hardly a title for a woman trying to shatter the image. She urged Barak to do his job. She could have argued that it was she who received the revelation. Look, I'm the one who got the revelation from God. She was a prophet. She did not use Barak's weakness as an opportunity to lead the army, her second opportunity to take over. She did not use Barak's hesitancy as the final straw to take over. In fact, when Barak did his job, what was she? Thrilled. Because that's what she could do. She could go back to do her job, couldn't she? And let me tell you something. Women, do this. And what man wouldn't want to do their job if they have this kind of encouragement behind them? Comments or questions? You've listened well. You've contributed much. Thank you for your work. George has songs.